Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to NeuroNoodles Neurofeedback and Neuropsychology Podcast, featuring tech legend Jake Gunkelman. He's the man who has read well over 500,000 brain scans, and Dr. Marie Swingle, author of iMinds. Our goal is to provide information and promote options for better mental health. The NeuroNoodle Podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you. Mark your calendars for Friday, April 26, 2024, as Bradley University hosts the 8th Annual Super Brain Summit, presented by the Center for Collaborative Brain Research. This year's topic, Rhythms of Regulation, Polyvagal Perspectives, promises an insightful exploration to polyvagal theory with Deb Dana, LCSW, leading the discussions as the featured speaker. Dana is a celebrated author and clinician, brings her extensive knowledge and practical experience to the forefront. The event will be held at the Hayden Clark Alumni Center's Peplo Pavilion, available both live and online, ensuring accessible participation for all interested. For those looking to register or seeking more information, please contact Gwen at ghowarter@bradley.edu or by phone at 309-677-3900. Further inquiries about the program can be directed to Dr. Lori Russell Chapin at lar@bradley.edu. Don't miss this enriching opportunity to engage with the latest advancements in brain research and polyvagal practices. Jay Gunkelman.
Good to see everybody.
Hi, Jay.
Jay, do you know Dad?
I don't recall meeting, but that's not unusual.
Not as well as you're going to know him at the end of an hour.
I haven't been out really for quite a few years now because of my medical mess. Keeps me pretty well here at home.
So, well, that helps. Yeah,
we share some similar circles, Jay, but I don't think you and I have actually met. So I mentored with Dr. Mary Tracy for about 2.5 years one-on-one.
Well, Mary and I end up intersecting quite often.
A birthday. Happy birthday, Mary.
Exactly. I said happy birthday. I hope all your...
We have Dr. Marie Swingle going to be popping in. It's almost like at a bar. People start showing up and we get around and we start talking about neurofeedback, mental health. Within 30 seconds, we'll be on a tangent. Hello, Dr. Mari Swingle. Mari.
Oh, you did it! You did it!
I say that. See, I got the Chicago dialect. I say it every time. you don't pick up on it.
David, are you familiar? Well, hello. Welcome. Are you familiar with our running joke about Pete's mispronunciations of my name?
No, I haven't caught up on that one.
Okay.
But I think I've been... I might be mispronouncing it as well. So,
well, that's all Pete's fault.
that's what you need a good video editor for.
Yeah, just leave in. It's all Pete's fault, and we're okay.
That's right. That's right. I take no credit, but all the blame. Dr. David, first time on the show. Welcome aboard.
Thank you. Second time, though, Pete.
Second time? What was the first time?
About a year ago.
Holy cow. Who was on? Just me?
And the two psychologists you used
oh,
to
have. My sister, Dr. Laura and Skip.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. All right. My mea culpa. That was a while ago. That was a while ago now. We're
been a while, yeah.
All right. Well, thank
that's
you.
When you were that's when you were at maybe 500 subscribers, right?
You know, in the internet world and YouTube, it could be 2,000 or 30,000. It all matters who's watching, like right now. So,
yeah.
So, help, you know, give us your background again. Cause what I have in the back of my mind is use neurofeedback to help out in couples counseling. Is that correct?
Yeah. So, I'm really using brain maps to help with couples counseling. Neurofeedback. So most of the couples that I see are on the edge of divorce. And so we don't have the luxury of time to say, hey, let's hook you up and have some fun with the neurofeedback systems. So it really has more to do with using the brain maps as an understanding for why there's so much conflict in their relationship. And that provides a lot of insight. And then I can also create an aftercare plan with whatever other recommendations for additional therapies based off of my clinical experience and also the brain map data. I have used neurofeedback with couples before, and I let them know that there's not a ton of research on that, but you know there's some things that I can kind of intuitively work on, and there is some you know case study type you know examples of what could help for people, and you know so I've done that. I don't know, a dozen sessions probably in the last few years. So it's not a frequent process.
Well, by the time somebody's getting a divorce and they go to the counselor, that's all over.
That's... Well, not necessarily.
Just personal experience.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, David, but I find that the thing that makes many of us that work with couples very sad is they come too late. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah,
I find that, you know, I usually sell people the average person comes to see me 5 to 10 years later than they should have probably. But, yeah. You know, in my experience, you know what I often tell couples and I'm sure we'll say it on the you know, recording at some point is that, you know, my job is to make sure when you interact with each other, you have more oxytocin and endorphins released than stress hormones like, you know, cortisol and adrenaline. And a lot of people are wired through often childhood traumas to just hit that fight or flight so quickly.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of undoing that can take place through therapy, through neurofeedback, through understanding their neuropsychology. And, you know, that's what I try to bring into it. My background is in neuroscience and I got roped into couples work, which is a longer story.
I think it's lovely though. It's a beautiful angle that I do not think enough people are working in. I mean, I don't mind disclosing, David, and maybe you can share a little bit that I do neuro and I do couples. And when I have couples that agree to the neuro, I kind of do my secret happy dance because we all know that we're going to be able to see things that can really, really help. And as long as the couple isn't in too aggressive a phase of the relationship, well, I say it's your brain, your fault, wink, wink. No, but it makes a huge difference to get to the core, to the psychoneurophysiology. Can you speak a little bit more to that?
Sure. So we're rolling, I assume, at this point.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. I forgot. I last time I remember Pete did a formal intro, and I guess that's all aftermarket now.
That was 3 years ago.
We'll okay. Be fun, casual. We rant a lot now, too, which is kind of fun.
Tangents. David, I'm going to push the boat out to sea, and let's see where the current goes.
It's great. This is the most prepared I've been for an interview before. So,
sounds like couple counseling.
Right. So I'm sorry, I got sidetracked. What was your question again?
I was just speaking generally that we frequently in my practice anyways, and I don't think I'm the only one, that we work in different modalities, and my major modality is neurotherapy, but I also do couples work. But frequently couples, I'm not saying they're resistant, but they really don't understand the potential of looking at the brain rather than the metaphorical heart to help with the couples counseling, the resolution of argument, looking at argument style, looking at things that contribute. So when I do have a couple that does say, hey, we want to try this, and it is more expensive, it's just I do my little secret happy dance, because I know the likelihood of resolution, as well as I would say empathy for where the person is coming from, is higher. I would love to hear more about your experience, what components really work for your work in that regard.
Yeah, I love the question. And anytime I hear of other couples therapists that are also they're in the neurofeedback world, I also do my happy dance. So I think you can't see my legs under the desk, but I think we're both tapping right now.
Where's Snoopy?
Yeah, exactly. So my foundation working with couples is communication skills. I think everyone needs to learn fundamental communication skills in order to have a mutually satisfying and fulfilling marriage or relationship. And what I find is that the couples that can get the communication skills and really run with it are successful. Now, the couples that can't usually have some neurological block, if you will. And that's where I think neurofeedback is so fantastic, and that the extra investment, you know, depending on what your marriage is worth to you, the extra investment can be really worth it. And you know, as a side note, I often have people say, well, I don't know if I, you know, have the money to spend on, you know, the neurofeedback or a couples retreat and my response, depending on how much humor I want to add at the moment, is, well, then you're really going to hate divorce, because that's going to cost you a lot more money than anything you're going to spend in my office. Yeah. And so, you know, what I tell people is that all the skills that I'm teaching in a session are all in your cortex somewhere, for the most part. And that when your brain is hijacked with that emotional response, then your cortex is just offline. I mean, once that amygdala and that fight or flight response kicks in, then good luck accessing any of the skills that I've taught you through, you know, our time together. And I think that neurofeedback and the understanding of neurophysiology in general provides us with a really helpful concrete explanation for people of, okay, so when your partner rolls their eyes at you, yeah, you know, that's a little bit insulting, but it also reminds you of when your mother and father used to dismiss everything you said as a child, and you go back to being a five-year-old boy, and here's the neurology behind why that happens, and here's some empowering tools to help you stay in your body and overcome that in service of, you know, your marriage, but also, by the way, your own personal well-being in the end.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
The QEEG, the map, how does that come into play to get them to sit for, you know, 20 minutes and do that? And especially with a guy says, hey, man, just fix it. how does that work?
So I find I work with a lot of engineers, and engineers love brain maps. They want to see what's going on under the hood, and like, so you can look to see why I might be in conflict with my spouse. And I'm like, yeah, definitely. Let's pop the hood and take a look at this. So I have two examples of this. One of them is a spouse who has a fast processing speed. So their PDR at PZ is, you know, through the roof. And then the other spouse, their counterpart, has issues in Wernicke's area and are not processing information correctly, appropriately, accurately, however you want to conceptualize that. And so that leads to people saying, well, you're not listening to me, you don't understand me. And actually, neurologically, your, you know, spouse A is providing too much information probably, and spouse B just can't digest it at that rate. And when I've seen that on a brain map, I often recommend they write letters to each other, because you can write a letter as fast as you want, and then the person can read it as slow as they want. And it actually, it allows them to come together in communication without having to try to, you know, improvise that in real time. And real time is different for each of them in that case. The second example I'll give is if both partners have a fast processing speed, my experience is that the escalation goes from 0 to 100 in like a half a second.
Yeah.
And so what I do is I teach a lot of body-based relaxation. I might even have them do some diaphragmatic breathing before every marital check-in, because it just helps reset that processing speed, get them into their body a little, and then they have a fighting chance at using the skills that I'm teaching.
Let's take a peek at some interpersonal connectivity. Now, your work kind of hypothesizes that when they're in the right state, that they have a better connection, and that is going to be a beneficial state. And there might be those that would kind of, you know, show me the data sort of a thing, you know. What I'd like to suggest is, this is a publication from 2010 in the Journal of Scientific Exploration, which is more of an engineering journal than an EEG journal. In fact, I threatened to pull the paper from the journal when they were having trouble understanding some of the EEG stuff. So, but they said, no. You know, they brought in an EEG person and agreed with me. So, this is basically looking at a healer-healee connection and the ability to have that at a distance. Now, if you have a connection at a distance, there has to be a mechanism for the connection. There's no secret wire or something. So there has to be some mechanism for that connection. So, and Luke basically invited me to look at the EEG data on Bill Bankston and his Healy's he's actually a sociology professor who learned his technique and actually teaches it as well. Anyway, if you look at his EEG at rest, he has a slightly faster alpha peak, a little bit above 10 hertz. You know, he's a bright guy. He's a professor. You know, slightly faster alpha is not unusual. This is the bispectra. And we're looking at the bispectra because in work previously, Luke saw that I had published about or presented about consciousness, and cross-frequency coupling was a part of how that all worked. And this display can show that when it happens. Now, this is just basically 11 and 11. These axes are the same frequency, so you expect points to intersect on the 45, and this is a simple peak, and not much interesting on the bispectrum. And if you watch the EEG, when he starts to do his healing, this is the spectra. Instead of an 11 hertz alpha peak, he's down at 7.81, and it has harmonics. And you can see the harmonic interactions here. This is about a 7.81, but it has, you know, double that, triple that. But the fourth and fifth harmonic end up being in the gamma frequency range. But this is hitting a frequency that creates a standing potential. The Schumann resonances end up creating a standing potential, which can have a distant effect, like Tesla lighting lights at a distance with no wire using standing potentials. So this is the state that he's in. Now, let's look at the interaction between the healer and the healee. Now, this is Bill kicking in on his 7.81 run of background activity. This is amplified, and these are all parietal electrodes that have, you know, good opportunity to have an alpha in them. And the Healy has an amplified signal because the size of their EEG is so small. So it's a little thicker line. and you can use that to identify which is which. When he starts to make his run of 7.81, you can see that they're actually out of phase. Their waveforms are out of phase, but within a second, they're in phase. And when they're in phase, it amplifies the Healy's signal. If you're in an opera house room that has a harmonic, if you're singing and you hit that harmonic, your voice rides on itself, so it amplifies. So this is the Healy and Healer connecting, and it amplifies the state on the Healy. Anyway, this is the ability to have a connection at a distance. And again, it uses Schumann resonances, which are, a lot of people don't really understand that. It's an electromagnetic wave that surrounds the Earth. And the ionosphere and the ground are conductive, and the air in between is semiconductive. It's a capacitive space that can have a resonance. And the resonance is the Schumann resonances, plural. And a primary frequency, and then lots and lots of harmonics. Anyway, this...
Jake, jump in here just with a little aside, riding the wave, ha-ha. But, you know, when you're talking about when you're in perfect match, or if I can get into musical language, perfect pitch with the two individuals, in musical terms, we're talking about the overtone. And you could kind of think about it as the marital overtone. So the two individuals in harmony or harmonic, and then you get your overtone, which is the couple. So that can be a beautiful metaphor to work with.
Stochastic resonance.
That doesn't sound as dirty, though.
Well, it depends upon, you know, I thought it was pretty good stuff. Not only do they hit this frequency, which is the bass frequency, but all those high harmonics end up being in the signal. The interesting thing is we consider this the connection, but in healing there's a delivery, not just a connection. If I ring you up on the phone and you pick up the line, we have a connection, but we don't have a conversation yet. So we think this is the connection between the healer and the Healy. The delivery, you know, what is the delivery is another matter. And it's probably associated with the higher frequencies, nested rhythms in the EEG. You have a carrier frequency of theta or alpha. The nested rhythm of gamma is the content. So there's a difference between the connection and the content. And we hypothesize that there are higher frequencies that end up being the actual delivery. But we at least can show with solid evidence, made it into an engineering journal, that the connection can happen. But if you roll back recollection to the early days of biofeedback and neurofeedback, the Biofeedback Research Society, one of the really powerful characters was Barbara Brown. And she was a bold, big voice, and she ran the small events wherever she was. She was really a powerful young researcher, and she had a designed where there was a slit. You could only see your partner's eyes, and you had to press a button when you felt like you were connected. And basically, when the person was making theta frequencies, the both of them hitting the button at the same time was a higher probability. 7.81 is actually 7.83 is classic Schumann resonance frequency, but it varies slightly up and down based on seasonal thickness of the atmosphere. So we caught it at 7.81 when we were in Arizona at the time. But you can get it at various frequencies, but it's in the theta frequency band. So in all likelihood, Barbara Brown's early work was already kind of peeling away the lack of understanding of what this connectivity was all about.
I want to throw in another one. And David, I'd love to hear your perspective as well. But in couples, when both individuals have excessive high beta at FZ, we kind of, it's a horrible joke, but we call that the divorce signature, you know, meaning the cognitive rigidity when you lock onto something you can't let go. So what we call the circulative arguments. Any thoughts yourself on there? Or are you also working with beta and high beta at FZ?
Yeah, I mean, I find that the beta frequencies in my experience are easier to train. And, you know, that hyperexcitable cortex seems like you can teach people to kind of calm down or give them some CBT skills to get out of it. You know, I get more concerned about higher theta frequencies in the anterior cingulate, where there's some other like limbic involvement and the more kind of deeper rumination OCDs, especially if they have more ventral. Am I getting that right? Yes, more ventral slowing. Based on the Loretta, then I see more of that emotional content where they get stuck. And then, you know, it's one thing to walk people through like a logical argument of, okay, well, they said this, but you know, what do you think they meant? And let's go through some techniques. But when it's like, well, the way they looked at me, you're like, well, wait a minute.
Tangible, please. Tangible.
Yeah, exactly.
But the anterior cingulate, when it's working, gives you cognitive and emotional flexibility. And when it's not working, whether it's in theta, or alpha or beta, when it's not working, you lose that flexibility. And obviously the beta one, what you've seen as an anterior cingulate marker of that obsessive circumstance. Now, the slow pattern is actually the worst of the three because it's medication resistant to traditional pharma. Now, we have seen that it tends to respond fairly well to the use of dissociatives like ketamine, as long as they don't have paroxysms in the EEG or gigantic beta spindles in the EEG. Ketamine with frontal theta at the cingulate tends to have a very positive outcome. And again, with a caveat that the dissociatives with epileptiform content, they don't match up well. And beta spindles, not quite as predictive as the epileptiform content, but beta spindles are also a predictor of negative outcome. And you don't want to have a K-hole experience. You know, it's first time I heard about that, K-hole. Geez, I don't know what it is, but it sure doesn't sound very good, you know. So
I'm, as you, everybody knows, I'm still on the listening bench of all this, but my horrible clinical humor is coming in, you know, in terms of, yeah, just drug up your clients. They'll all be happy. Send them to the bar. They'll go home hand in hand.
Well, during the administration of ketamine, the theta content at the frontal midline goes up tremendously, but after the session, it collapses. And the one thing that they see is that it has a tremendously enhanced connectivity. And the connectivity is enhanced with that. It's enhanced with DMT. It's enhanced with psilocybin. All of the hallucinogens basically end up having an enhanced connectivity. In fact, with ayahuasca, the synesthesia, the cross-sensory boundary experience where you hear something, you taste it, and if you smell something, you hear it. So those sensory areas don't normally talk to each other. They're not connected. But when you take ayahuasca, suddenly everything is connected. So you hallucinate. You know, the sound make your vision go, and you know, the vision makes your taste change. So all of those sensories are crossed over in a way that you don't normally experience, and the amount of gamma in the EEG goes up huge. It's larger than the Dalai Lama monk's gamma, but then they did it themselves. They didn't have you know, some joy juice to create it, you know. David Stuckey got his PhD carrying a Lexicore, a gigantic old amp, not some nice little thing that we've got nowadays, down to the Amazon. And you have to plug it in. And the shamans weren't going to do their thing in the village. So he had a generator in the village with extension cords plugged together all the way out into the jungle where they were going to do their ceremony. And so this jerry-rigged thing, he had two shamans who did it, and he recorded them. And they're active, you know, they're moving, and, you know, EG's, you know, this isn't a lab, you know. So they were difficult recordings, but they were adequate. And he brought the data back, and his professor was going to dismiss it as all EMG. And poor David was, you know, beside himself. Oh, there goes my PhD dissertation. You know, I gotta come up with a whole different dissertation. And going to the Amazon pretty well tapped his budget. So, he brought the data to me because I had written a book about artifacts. And I looked at it and I said, well, this is the biggest gamma hypersynchrony I've seen since the Dalai Lama's data.
Mark your calendars for Friday, April 26, 2024, as Bradley University hosts the 8th Annual Super Brain Summit, presented by the Center for Collaborative Brain Research. This year's topic, Rhythms of Regulation, Polyvagal Perspectives, promises an insightful exploration to polyvagal theory with Deb Dana, LCSW, leading the discussions as a featured speaker. Dana is a celebrated author and clinician, brings her extensive knowledge and practical experience to the forefront. The event will be held at the Hayden Clark Alumni Center's Peplo Pavilion, available both live and online, ensuring accessible participation for all interested. For those looking to register or seeking more information, please contact Gwen at ghowarter@bradley.edu or by phone at 309-677-3900. Further inquiries about the program can be directed to Dr. Lori Russell Chapin at lar@bradley.edu. Don't miss this enriching opportunity to engage with the latest advancements in brain research and polyvagal practices.
And he said, well, Frank said that this was all EMG. And I said, well, it's hypercoherent. Muscle is not hypercoherent. So the hypercoherence is broken up in the temporal area where the muscle is, but the general hypercoherent gamma is a drug effect. And so he went back and had to argue that with his professor, but the professor had to kind of back off when he showed it was actually hypercoherent, and you can't do that with muscle. So he got his PhD off of that, but it showed that hyperconnectivity in ayahuasca, and it... you know, if you cross sensory boundaries, it's not normal perception. It doesn't all remain, but it does open up the door to perception, is an old phrase from, you know, other authors. But you do have the ability to, once open, kind of remember that these things can cross. So
actually, I want to ask kind of a follow-up question about that, Jay. Since I have the expert in front of me, I might as well take advantage here. You know, one of the things I see in the sessions is when couples enter dissociative states based on their trigger, you know, they really need time to come back down, and they need grounding in order to then have that connection. And I'm guessing some alpha synchrony in order, you know, they need that grounding in order to have that. And it makes intuitive sense, I think, to anyone that's worked with couples, but I would imagine you have some EEG to back that up.
Yeah. Dissociation. And Ruth, who was on the show previously, Linus, did some nice research with Thomas Ross, who was also on the show earlier. And their fMRI work showed that dissociation in trauma is localized to the insula, which is deep. This is a limbic cortex, and It's associated with the salience network, but it's also the location that has sympathetic parasympathetic balance. So their homeostatic balance is going to be tilted potentially to sympathetic over arousal by it, and kick in the salience network, turns off the default mode. So you're no longer in a resting state. You're kicked on, and the executive network is on. You're analytic. You're not homeostatic anymore. So that as a trigger point can exist, and you can see it in the EEG if it's an existent trigger point. You have to know what to look for. It's not, it's not seen by most people who look, but it's a very subtle feature in the EEG. You have in-phase activity at the lateral frontal and anterior temporal, that they have their activity going at the same, they're both going. And it's out of phase with CZ, and you don't see anything at C3 because the insula is firing out, the pyramidal cell is oriented out, so you get the primary field at the lateral frontal and temporal area. The butt end of that pyramidal cell dipole gets picked up at CZ. It's going back and forth under C3, so you don't see any of it there. If you map it, you get something here, you get something here, and nothing in between. So people kind of don't know what they're really looking at when they see that in the data set. And when I see it go by in the raw EEG, I say, well, there it is. Yeah, that's the left insula or the right insula. And the right insula ends up being important for emergency stopping, impulse control, affective gating. And I've seen a few couples that had difficulty with affective gating and impulse control. So the right insula in those couples ends up being off. In ERP work, event-related potential work, there's a fancy test, a go-no-go stop test. And like a go-no-go is, you either hit the button or don't hit the button. In this test, you get told to hit the button, and then they pop up this freaking stop sign. So you're in the process of hitting the button, and you have to stop. This emergency stop, and the fMRI work on that shows the amygdala, the anterior insula, and the operculum, the lateral frontal area. That's your emergency stop network. And all this lateral frontal stuff that you end up seeing is that breaking, there's a 98-pound weakling at the gate, the brake system is out, so. The insula is a critical piece, and it's deep, and it's not easy to get at unless you can actually see it. But think about it. You have an out-of-phase CZ to the temporal. That makes for a perfect neurofeedback montage. Things are out of phase, give you a big signal. So you can target it really nicely if you know what you're looking at, and target it and pick the right frequencies. You can end up flagging them when their insula is firing.
That's great. My wife is a child therapist, and I forget what book this is from, but there was a quote that she shared with me recently where, if you want to end all human suffering, put a stop to childhood trauma. And I really like that, because even with couples that I see, their wiring took place years before. And once that, that insular involvement gets in the way of living life, it really causes a lot of damage, a lot of issues. I'd be curious how many people that have been married 3, 4, 5 times have similarities in their brain maps.
Well, now we have a couple of candidates here.
Hey. So I think the greatest gift that you can, my opinion, the greatest gift that you can give somebody that would be coming into a counseling session is, they're coming in and they don't feel like they have control over their life or situation. And is it possible that the simplest thing that you can do to give that gift is just put the temperature sensor on the finger and just show that, you know, when you're stressed, your fingers colder, you know, something like that. Anybody want to pop in and talk about that?
I would use electrodermal as opposed to temperature. Temperature is a very slow changing signal, and but electrodermal is really reactive. Hook up a simple little GSR2, the little kind of a throwaway device, or one of the more modern ones, and ask a question that has any emotional thing about it at all. And there's a brief delay. You can kind of go and a one and a two and a boom, there's the response. So and when you have a response like that, you can't say, oh, I didn't respond, you know. It was it's face valid that you had an affective kick. Couples that have those on at the same time kind of see who's triggering whom and when and with what. And if you learn control over your electrodermal, you've got control over your sympathetic nervous system, and the sympathetic parasympathetic balance is something you've got control over. And that's a really big step forward. HRV helps with that, and direct electrodermal feedback helps with that. Unfortunately, she's passed. Anna Wise had a very nice approach to mapping consciousness with EEG arousal on one axis and body arousal on the other axis using electrodermal. And you could be highly aroused physically and low aroused mentally, or vice versa, or both high, both low. You know, but that matrix of arousal mixes ended up predicting states really well. So and electrodermal is probably one of the cheapest. Well, I guess the little temperature thermometer that they give you for free is the cheapest. But again, it's a very slow changer. It changes over, you know, minutes. It's not quick. It's effective, but it's not quick. And electrodermal is.
Though, Jay, too, is females tend to have a much, much harder time regulating temperature. So in terms of frustration level, in terms of couples therapy, no, the guy is going to be blowing up the temperature and the female isn't. So it can.
If I can add to that, too, you know, in the sessions, so I should clarify that most of my work is a couples retreat. So I'm only seeing them for 3 or 4 days for the most part. And then I often don't see them again. They fly in, they do their work, and then they fly out and go back home. So I use respiration because I can see the respiration in the room. And my experience is when you're training people in HRV and temperature and GSR and all these things, you're often using respiration as the training, you know, module. And so I'm just looking, and sometimes I'll say, you know, hey, I noticed when, you know, your husband just said that, it looks like you kind of, you held your breath and your shoulders went up just a little bit. What are you feeling right now? And I try to bring in the biofeedback principles with me sort of as the machine. And then the other piece of this is I want to put in a plug for Dr. Swingle's book, because I love iMinds, absolutely love iMinds. And I mention it to many, many couples. I did a blog post maybe 2 years ago when Apple came out with one of its new phones. I was like, oh, great, this is a perfect opportunity. And I wrote a blog that said, touch your spouse more than your phone.
Yes.
And I had the lowest reception of any blog that I had written. People even wrote me and said, yeah, but I wake up and I look at my email and like I have to. They got like me for suggesting you should, you know, give your wife and husband a hug before you check your Instagram account. And I went, oh my God, that's not good.
It's bad. It's bad now. Yeah. I mean, number one rule: do not bring electronica into the bedroom. period. You know, you ask the kids to turn in their devices at 9. Perhaps you should do that yourselves. Yeah,
I have. I have the exception of like an Aura Ring as a device. But that's the kind of thing you want to have monitoring you, or a Fitbit on your, or an Apple Watch, or you know, something to be able to monitor your physiology is an okay technology to have in the room, but it shouldn't be bright. And it shouldn't have any sound to it.
I tell people, if you bring something into the bedroom, it should vibrate and not have a screen.
I don't know about the first one.
we have had a couple of shows on porn, but no, something that Jay was mentioning, I want to add a little bit to as well, in terms of, you know, looking at couples independently in biofeedback. Okay, so electrodermal response, et cetera. But one of the really cool things is actually to wire them together. So you get a response, but the couple doesn't know who the response is from. The therapist does. But then the job of the couple is to bring down the arousal level of the couple not knowing who the source is. Okay, and that can be extremely powerful as well.
So is that like having two dogs with a bark collar that shocks them, and one dog barks and they both get a shock? You know, which one did it?
Maybe a little softer, but yeah.
Yeah.
No, it literally forces the couple to work together, right?
Yeah, I often teach co-breathing exercises. You know, I tell people that, you know, when you do biofeedback on an infant, oftentimes you're laying the infant over the mother's heart and you're actually training the mom, and there's some entrainment that takes place. But that pathway is still present in adults. And if you lay down and you do some diaphragmatic breathing and sync with your partner, it's an amazing feeling of connection. And I've always wanted to do, you know, brain maps on people as they're doing their breathing, but you know, again, I'm working with people that are about to get divorced, and so I can't get into all the fun stuff usually.
Well, at least they want things to change, right? You can do everything except create the desire to have a better outcome, right? So if you show that it is within your control to change things, you can either change it, you know, pay up for the divorce and deal with all that crap, or try to fix. I hate the word fix, okay? I know you guys go crazy about fix, but you know, correct, put the boat on a different course, whatever it is. Now, the couples flying to see you, would virtual work at this? Obviously, you want to see them, and because, you know, you have these the helmets you can send out, you know, put on, you know, dry sensor. Obviously, it wouldn't work as well as seeing them in person, but do you see the future of that happening?
As soon as the psychology board can update its terms and get rid of this whole state licensing bureaucracy, then I think there's something to that, Pete. You know, so I'm licensed in 4 states right now. And so if I have someone from one of those states, you know, reach out to me, Vermont, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Florida, because it's super easy to get licensed in Florida as a psychologist. It's really odd. So if they're in one of those states, then I use the, you know, wherever it is on my desk here, I use my MindLift. I like the MindLift system. It doesn't do complex kinds of trainings. It's only, you know, monopolar trainings. But for a lot of people, that works really well. You know, I tell them, you know, there's a difference between a $300 system and a $20,000 system if you go to someone's office. I mean, you're getting what you pay for in that sense. But it can really do a nice job of a virtual and remote training. And I've spoken with the folks at MindLift to talk about, you know, hey, what do you think of like getting 2 Bluetooth connections to one tablet? And is there some future there? So if anyone's using MindLift and that's something you're interested in, then send them an email, because the more they hear that feedback, the more likely they are to, you know, start working on it.
Can I be a devil's advocate?
Sure.
Okay. Now, obviously, if distance is a real issue, this is an absolute moot point. But apart from in COVID, where there was no other choice, if a couple cannot coordinate themselves to come into your office, you know, I really have commitment issues in terms of that. The other is just in terms of the subtleties of what the therapist can see and not see online versus in person. All of that is lost. The other feature is the couple is looking into the stream. You know, a lot, they're not, sometimes they're in two different locations themselves, or they're in, like the focus again is on the screen instead of on each other. That's a huge one. And the third one is silence. Silence is always an issue. It's a negative space online versus in couples therapy. It can be a very, very powerful modality, and not in the negative, also in the positive. So in terms of, you know, David, I'd love to hear your perspective. I always want to start in person. If you need to do a few things online in the interim, that's one thing. Now, of course, I'm not talking about the equipment at this point, but just in terms of interactive power. Your thoughts? Are we going to battle this out, or are you with me?
I don't have my boxing gloves with me, but I do see it a little bit differently. So, you know, I tell people you're going to get better at what you practice. Most people come to couples therapy because they became really good at arguing or avoiding. And so in the therapy sessions, I'm more interested in them talking to each other than talking to me. And, you know, I have to do my intakes and I have to do some skill-based, you know, education. But I actually send them an online course ahead of time where they get all the background info before they see me. So then I'm really working on application. Right. And so I agree with you that if the couple is in the same physical space, you will get better results. And that's where I draw a very hard line. If they're going to log in from two different areas, I've even had people log in the same house in two different computers. And I go, yeah, no, this isn't okay. You know, so they have to be
with each other.
They have to be in the same physical space. Now, part of my dissertation looked at the outcomes and the opinions of in-person versus virtual work. And this was in before the pandemic. I finished my dissertation in 2015. So, and what the research showed at that point anyway, is that therapists often don't want to do virtual. They like in person. They feel more, capable in person, but clients feel just as comfortable going virtual. And the result, as long as someone is well trained in the difference in dynamics, is relatively equal. Now, I think you have to be careful there about, well, what are you treating? Is there a good reason to go in person? You know, I often feel like the intake process can be done virtually. And there's also some cost benefit analysis. So for example, you know, it's a few thousand dollars to do a couples retreat. And if someone's really scraping the money together and the flights and the hotel and the childcare would be a barrier to treatment, then I go, fine, let's do it virtually. If virtual seems like there's an avoidance coming up, which is why they want to do it, I'm totally on board with you that, well, then we need to address the avoidance, right? Because this isn't going to work. During the pandemic, I was doing a virtual session because we had to. And the only time this has ever happened to me, someone said, I'm overwhelmed and I need a break. I said, great self-advocacy, go take your break. We'll come back in a few minutes. And then they both go off screen and I see this giant billow of smoke come into the screen. And I go, so what did you do on your break? And I said, oh, we needed to light up the bong because we needed a minute. And I went, well, that's going to change the therapy now.
Yeah, it's going to work.
So in my work, having most recently focused more on intractable epilepsy, that has to start with office work. And the deep analytics of coming up with where to train and how to train. And then you have to make sure that the idea of what to train and how to train is actually working as intended. But once you get past maybe the first dozen sessions in an office, this is going to be 100 or more sessions. And, you know, Isabella more recently did 350 before her seizures quit. What's the logistics of getting to and from the office 100 or 300 times? You know, so just, you know, let's get this remote, but remote that we can actually monitor and interact within. You let me do screen sharing, and you can see camera. So if I had an electrode in the wrong spot, you could kind of see. And if you were able to control my computer and the software was there, you could reset the thresholds as needed. So monitoring at a distance can be done, and it's not the same as being face to face with everything, but it's been shown based on the actual outcomes to work. We've the last six intractable epileptics are all seizure free, medication free, with the exception of one who just she went into the hospital. They did an EEG and saw some irregularities, and they put her back on Keppra. She hadn't had a seizure, but she had EEG irregularities, and they put her back on Keppra. So she's back on low dose of medication for a while. But the epileptologist is controlling the meds based on their EEG work. But she's still seizure free, and she's been seizure free now for 6 years, and Isabella for over 7 years. So it works with distance training, but again, it has to be set up properly at the beginning. You can't kick them out of the office after one session and make them guess as to where the electrode is supposed to go and expect outcomes to really work.
The uneducated one here, his thoughts are, that would be me, that couples, they run into problems about money, okay? And this stuff isn't cheap. Insurance doesn't pay for it, or very little. So it's more than rich people and people in urban areas that have problems. If you're rural and you don't have any money, you need something, right? And, you know, there's a market out there to do it. I agree coming in, but you look at, you know, few hundred million people in the United States, it's more besides the urban areas and the rich that, you know, need the help.
Yeah. I would also add to that, though, that it's also a matter of priority. I mean, I've worked with people, you know, I just worked with someone a few weeks ago who he was cheating on his partner. He didn't know why. He cognitively wanted to stop, but he was kind of stuck in this cycle and he couldn't figure it out. And he told me that, you know, I didn't want to pay your fees, but when I told my friends about your service and that, you know, I don't think I can afford it, my friend almost smacked me in the face and said, you just bought two snowboards last week. Like, what are your priorities here? And, you know, I think of that every time I drive by the Lexus dealership. Like, they have no trouble selling those cars, probably to people that are getting divorced, too.
Yeah. In epilepsy, the cost savings of not having epilepsy is tremendous. The case Maggie, which had a little video shot about her, they were paying for Onfi, a brand name aggressive anticonvulsant. She was on three, but just the Onfi itself was $1,000 out of pocket copay a month. So getting rid of the epilepsy is like suddenly having a second job income, you know. So and that was one medication. There's copays on the rest and her treatments and everything. So, and the worrying about SUDEP, sudden death from epilepsy, that is always kind of dangled over your head as they try to suggest that you have brain surgery as the next step. You know, that's expensive. And if you can learn how to stop it in 100 sessions, you've bought the device yourself, so you're not really paying per session, you know, in the same way you would in an office. So we've tried to make it workable and affordable. It's not been my idea of a source of income. Families contact me with desperate circumstances with kids that have intractable epilepsy, and I don't even charge them for the EEG analysis. You know, the they're going to spend more money on the treatment and the assessment from me. You know, I'm old. I'm doing okay. I don't need to charge them for that. So
my point is the price is the price. Okay.
Yeah.
But why isn't insurance covering this?
Before insurance, though, Pete, I think one of the things is it's just conceptual if we go down. And I think this is also the insurance companies as well. Okay. People will invest in their future. They'll see the end product. So they'll pay for something they get in their hands. What we're doing is you're paying to not have something. Okay. And it's a really interesting concept to wrap your head around. You're paying so that you will not need future education, to pay for future education. You are paying so you will not need to have a tutor through the next 10 years of your education. You're paying so that you will not need to pay a divorce lawyer. You're paying so that you will not need to pay for a second residence, a second car, split homes, right? But people don't see it that way. So you really, individuals really need to wrap their head around, you're paying to not have something. You're not paying to have something. So anybody who can put that to the insurance companies, that's the way to rotate it. Different lens.
I've had one client in the last 15 years, when appropriately billing for neurofeedback, because I know some people skew things, but when appropriately billing, I've had one client that got reimbursed, and it was because he was severely depressed. He'd been in and out of inpatient facilities at, $10,000 a pop. So that's, 50, 60, 70,000 every year for so many years. And his parents, paid out of pocket for the treatment, sent the insurance company my invoices for $4,000 for the whole treatment and said, hey, we just saved you $60,000 for the next 5 years. How about you reimburse us? And they did it. They did reimburse the family. Nice. And we had a nice celebration in the office for his last session. And, last I knew he's doing okay. That was, 10 years ago or something.
Yeah.
You have those codes offhand?
Yeah. It's what's the code for, persistent mom.
Yeah, indeed.
Dr. David Helfin, thank you for coming on the show. How do people find out more about you? What are your digits, details, URLs?
Yeah, so let me put in a quick plug here. My parents have been running couples retreats for 40 years. They have one of the highest rated retreat programs in the U.S. They also work internationally with people. And they just want to enjoy the sunshine now and play with their grandkids and have some fun. So I'm actually taking over their business. This is a transition year. We're all very excited about it. And so if you go to marriagequest.org, you'll find contact info. They're still seeing about 4 to 6 couples a year. And then, I'm taking the rest of the inquiries. So it's been a fun journey, and I'm excited to take the torch and run with it now.
Oh, outstanding. Jay Gunkelman, Dr. Marie.
It's an epigenetic business.
You'll always have customers. Dr. Marie Swingle, Jay Gunkelman, Dr. David Helfin, thank you. Awesome episode of the NeuroNoodle Neurofeedback Podcast. Adieu. The NeuroNoodle Podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you. Mark your calendars for Friday, April 26, 2024, as Bradley University hosts the 8th Annual Super Brain Summit, presented by the Center for Collaborative Brain Research. This year's topic, Rhythms of Regulation, Polyvagal Perspectives, promises an insightful exploration through polyvagal theory with Deb Dana, LCSW, leading the discussions as a featured speaker. Dana is a celebrated author and clinician, brings her extensive knowledge and practical experience to the forefront. The event will be held at the Hayden Clark Alumni Center's Peplo Pavilion, available both live and online, ensuring accessible participation for all interested. For those looking to register or seeking more information, please contact Gwen at ghowarter@bradley.edu or by phone at 309-677-3900. Further inquiries about the program can be directed to Dr. Lori Russell Chapin at LA they are at bradley.edu. Don't miss this enriching opportunity to engage with the latest advancements in brain research and polyvagal practices.